figuring out who shot down Flight 17. Today, Friday, July 18th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. Ukraine says Russian-backed rebels shot down the Malaysia Airlines jet with a missile. President Obama says it's too early to know who did it, but he adds this.
We have confidence in saying that that shot was taken within a territory that is controlled by the Russian separatists.
We'll hear from the Ukrainian ambassador to NATO and get reaction from Amsterdam and Moscow. And later, we hear what the war in Gaza is like for residents there.
It's very difficult for people to know where they should go and where they can be safe.
Plus, a chat with Monty Python's John Cleese, where he answers most of my questions.
Now, Carol, I didn't come on here to talk about lemurs.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, an outrage of unspeakable proportions. That's what President Obama called the deaths of nearly 300 people whose plane was blown out of the sky yesterday over Ukraine. Obama spoke to reporters this afternoon.
What we have confidence in saying right now is that a surface-to-air missile was fired, and that's what brought the jet down. We have confidence in saying that that shot was taken within a territory that is controlled by the Russian separatists.
The president said it's too early to say who exactly fired the missile, but the government of Ukraine hasn't hesitated to point the finger at the separatists. Earlier, I spoke with Ukraine's ambassador to NATO, Ihor Dolhov, and I asked him what evidence his government has.
First, recently, over the last 3 days, Ukrainian military aircrafts have been downed by separatist groups. Secondly, today, the chief of security service of Ukraine presented publicly several intercepted phone conversations between terrorists and their bosses in Moscow. And it's quite clear that they discussed the situation and they proved that this system, Buk M, have been transferred from the Russian territory. And yesterday night we received alarming news here that those groups are trying to move this Buk M back to the Russian territory.
And this Buk M you mentioned is the kind of missile that it looks like has taken down this plane. In the instances you referred to of a Ukrainian military plane being shot down earlier, has it also been determined that that was from a Buk M?
Yes, there are several technical parameters and characteristics which could clarify the situation. And the targets was Ukrainian aircrafts on the altitude more than 6,000 meters. And in the situation with Malaysian Boeing, the altitude was more than 10,000 meters. And there are not so many systems which could reach the target at that distance. Russian-made Buk and S-300 systems.
Now, I know this is a sensitive question, but how do we know for sure it wasn't the Ukrainian military? This plane was shot down in the middle of a war zone. As you mentioned, it takes a significant weapon to blow a plane out of the sky.
We do not have weapon systems like that in the area because Ukrainian military conduct anti-terrorist operation. And we didn't suppose and we were not prepared that terrorists could have an aircraft like that. So we just didn't have such systems.
Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin has been holding Ukraine responsible for the tragedy, but he is also calling for direct talks between opposing sides. How would you characterize Ukraine's relationship with Russia at the moment?
Well, unfortunately, these relations are very limited, and we continue to call on Russia to negotiate the situation and to at least to close the border from Russian side. Because what we see every day, and every night especially, that more and more munition, arms, people, armed people, cross the border from the Russian territory. And probably you remember that not so long ago, President Poroshenko declared ceasefire unilaterally. And what happened? Terrorists continued to fight and to kill Ukrainian soldiers and civilians.
Now, this has just been a horrible tragedy for Ukraine and for so many other countries who had passengers on the plane. Ukraine itself has had a lot of difficulties in recent years. What are you hearing back from people back home in Ukraine?
Well, you know, yesterday I was staying here in NATO headquarters watching Ukrainian TV, and I was touched when I seen crowds of Ukrainian people who visited embassies of those countries whose people have been killed. And this emotional move of Ukrainians continue to go on today. Many and many just simple people, ordinary people from the street, pay a tribute to those victims of the terrorist attack. It's a moment of solidarity, of real international solidarity.
Ihor Dolhov is Ukraine's ambassador to NATO. He spoke to us from Brussels. Russia denies it had anything to do with shooting down the jet. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow, where he's monitoring the reaction from Russian officials.
They want an open international investigation. But that said, they're putting the blame on Kiev for not negotiating a peace settlement in the east. Putin has said that basically he's distancing Russia's role in any of this by saying what happens in Ukrainian territory is the responsibility of Kiev, which, you know, may strike some as a little bit strange, given that, you know, Putin's interest in Ukraine's territorial integrity wasn't always so strong. I mean, he's just annexed Crimea, and there's been a lot of tension certainly given to nationalist arguments here that Russia should also take over parts of eastern Ukraine.
But are Russian officials putting the blame on anybody?
Well, they're saying let's let the facts play out to this investigation, but they are certainly distancing Russia's role in any of this. For example, today the defense ministry issued a statement saying that no surface-to-air battery systems, missiles had crossed over the border into Ukraine. So they're certainly playing that down. The media is a different story, however.
Yeah, I was just about to ask, how is the Russian media playing the story?
Well, they certainly push a story that, you know, Russia also is innocent. This is Ukraine's fault, and they put it squarely on Ukraine. In fact, I would say they argue some very conspiratorial versions of what's happened. First of all, they say that they have witnesses on the ground, and they interview them by phone, who say that they've seen Ukrainian fighter jets attacking the airliner near Donetsk. They've also said that the defense ministry says its radars tracked rockets fired by the Ukrainian army. For a while, they were even suggesting that the real target of the fighter jet was Putin's plane as it was on its way back from South America. The Russian president was just there for the Brazil games and also just to meet with South American leaders.
What does Russian media say about that kind of back and forth between these separatists and other people in eastern Ukraine that Ukraine is saying proves that it was pro-Russian separatists?
You're talking about these recorded conversations?
Yes, the recorded conversations. You can hear them on the web.
Well, one thing is that they say that these are actually doctored, and this has certainly been put forth by some of the kind of more radical Russian nationalists who I must say, have become much more mainstream in the last few months here. It's not these are people who maybe once upon a time might have been considered somewhat marginal and now are actually in the mainstream and they're on the news. And so they're saying these recordings are doctored.
Now, there's a lot of chatter about who has the black boxes. Now, Ukraine is saying that Russia has them. What does Russia say about the black boxes?
There's been some interest in bringing the black boxes to Moscow, which I understand would have been protocol prior to this incident. But given the situation and sort of the ongoing conflict between Kiev and Moscow, that's not necessarily the case. The Russians are, again, saying that they want to be part of this international investigation into this incident, and they haven't said much. I've also understood from just speaking with various people here that if, in fact, this was, as it appears to be, an airliner that was taken out of the sky from a missile, there's really not a whole lot that the black box can tell you.
You've talked a lot about Russian media and Russian officials, but when you talk to Russians on the street or friends of yours, what's their take on this?
If you look at the political classes here and where people stand, you know, among the opposition, I think this is a sense that from all this kind of hysteria that's been whipped up over here over the last several months surrounding Ukraine, surrounding the annexation of Crimea, the Kremlin essentially was playing with fire, and now it's come back to haunt them, that somehow it appears, to their point of view, that you know, even if this was an accident, these guys were trigger-happy, and with encouragement from Moscow, this had turned into a complete disaster. But even among people that, you know, maybe don't subscribe completely to that view, I think they look at this as a disaster. I mean, you know, at this point, as they go forward with this investigation, if it turns out, in fact, that the rebels were behind this, it means Russia may face additional sanctions. We just had new sanctions issued by the United States and weaker ones by the European Union recently. It looks as though the Europeans would be on board for more stronger sanctions at that point. And essentially, you're looking at maybe some kind of Gaddafi scenario with around the Lockerbie bombings, if you remember that. It was a moment when essentially isolates the country for the long term.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. There were people of many nationalities on that Malaysian Airlines plane, but the majority of the dead were Dutch citizens. Relatives and friends rushed to Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport where the plane took off. Our BBC colleague Anna Holligan was there.
We've spent the last 24 hours at Schiphol Airport. We arrived at the same time as many of the relatives as they dashed through the security cordons and upstairs for news. They arrived with their hopes, many of them still intact, but they left. You could tell that they had been given this devastating news that there was no hope, no survivors on board MH17. The relatives of the passengers who were on board have been taken to a hotel. They're being cared for there by staff members. And we've also heard earlier from the senior vice president of Malaysia Airlines. He said that they are doing their best to make arrangements to allow those relatives to fly to Kiev and then take them on to the actual crash site in eastern Ukraine to see for themselves the remains of that flight.
It's just been a devastating tragedy for lots of people, but a huge majority of casualties were from the Netherlands. Have you heard of any relatives who are wanting to fly to Ukraine?
A huge majority from the Netherlands, indeed. And we've had a reaction from the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. He's called for a full independent investigation. He's had conversations with President Putin. The flags across the nation are flying at half mast. This is a country in mourning now. We're actually en route to a small village in the south of the Netherlands where we've had reports that one whole family was on board that flight, flying to Kuala Lumpur, a mother, a father, and four children. And there are images of tributes which have been laid at their doorstep. And many people are comparing this to America's 9/11. They say that this is the Netherlands 9/11.
We've also read that many of the victims were AIDS researchers on their way to a major conference in Melbourne. Have you spoken to any of the families of those victims?
We spoke to a member of that same AIDS organization earlier. One of her colleagues was on board the flight, and one of the most eminent professors in the field of AIDS research from the Netherlands was on board. So a huge loss to the medical field. They were all heading to this conference in Melbourne, which is scheduled to start on Monday. And actually, when we were at the airport earlier, there was another flight, MH17, taking off for Kuala Lumpur. So more people boarding and didn't seem to be too affected by the news of what had happened yesterday. And Malaysian Airlines are actually now taking an alternative route to avoid that conflict zone.
With so many of the victims being Dutch, I know there's tremendous sadness in the Netherlands, but is there also anger about what's happened?
From the papers, from people we're speaking to here, I think it's too early for anger. I think people are still in shock. There's so much mourning. We're talking now about memorial services that may be held in the coming days. But I think the anger will be next. And there are so many questions that people here feel are still unanswered. And that's why the Dutch Prime Minister is pushing not just for this independent investigation, but also for the bodies of those Dutch victims to be repatriated as soon as possible.
The BBC's Anna Holligan in the Netherlands covering this terrible tragedy about the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you.
Earlier today, President Obama also noted that many of the victims aboard Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 were AIDS researchers. He said these were men and women who had dedicated their lives to saving the lives of others.
In this world today, we shouldn't forget that in the midst of conflict and killing, there are people like these, people who are focused on what can be built rather than what can be destroyed, people who are focused on how they can help people that they've never met, people who define themselves not by what makes them different from other people, but by the humanity that we hold in common. It's important for us to lift them up and to affirm their lives.
President Obama earlier paying tribute to some of those who died yesterday when that jetliner was blown out of the sky over Ukraine. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. If you live in a neighborhood populated by hipsters, you know about yarn bombing. It's when knitted strips are attached to objects, like trees, making it look like they're wearing a little hand-knit sweater. Well, my colleague Andrea Crossan thought she spotted a massive yarn bombing when she was cycling across Boston's Massachusetts Avenue Bridge last weekend. It turns out what she saw along Mass Ave is part of a public art project.
It's not the easiest thing to explain an art exhibit on the radio. So here's my best attempt at describing the joining project. It's a bit like Christo wrapping buildings, and a bit like Andy Goldsworthy making sticks and twigs cool, and a bit like your grandma's knitted tea cozy. The project spans across the center of the bridge that connects the city of Boston with the city of Cambridge. And the artist behind it is Albanian-American Sylvie Nachi. She tells me about why she wanted to knit a sweater for a bridge.
So I remember being home when I was younger in Albania, and in the afternoon after everybody took a nap, a lot of the moms in the neighborhood would meet at somebody's house, and they would catch up and talk and let the kids play, and they would knit. So I thought there was such a awesome way to get people together. So I thought about turning this utilitarian bridge into a communal place for people to make art.
So with one knit and purl at a time, she collected pieces of knitwork from members of the community. Then she painstakingly attached each piece to the railing of the bridge. One of the biggest contributors was Nachi's mom.
She knitted my name. It says founder Sylvie Nachi, which is very sweet of her.
She's very proud of you.
I hope so. I think so. There's a lot of pieces that she even found when we were little, some of the scars that she had made us when we were little, and then she reused them for the project.
With scraps of woolly scarves and blankets and approval by the city, an art project was made. Nachi collects contributions she gets from members of the public and adds them to the exhibit.
What has made me very happy, not only with my mom, but a lot of other people, is that this is a platform for them to be an artist, that if some of them have never been in an art show or done any public art pieces. There's a piece here by somebody that says, "We love Boston." So many people have contributed at this point that I don't know the names of every person that has made the pieces.
The knitwork ranges from the intricate and beautiful to things that look more like my failed high school macrame project. But it's not about who knitted the prettiest piece. The overall effect of all the different colors of yarn and ribbon lining the bridge make it striking. Besides creating something aesthetically pleasing, this is also a memorial of sorts. Nachi is a runner, and she was on this bridge on marathon day last year when two bombs exploded at the finish line, killing three people and injuring hundreds.
I was right there. I was running right here on the bridge.
She says that the bombing was a sad reminder of her childhood in Albania.
Threats like this happened so much in Albania when I lived there. You know, my parents and I and my sisters moved here in hope that terrorism wouldn't follow us. I guess it happens everywhere, and it just was a very sad day.
Attached to each piece of knitting is a cardboard tag. Nachi asks contributors to write a wish on it. But it's been a wet July, so some of the messages have faded. Nachi says she thinks that means that the wish came true if it washed away. Like a gardener tending her flowers, Nachi comes to the bridge with a ball of yarn to do repairs, add more knitted squares, and watch members of the public take in her work.
As they walk through the bridge, they just hold on to the railing to feel all the knitting. And when I'm here on Sundays putting more pieces up, I just see them smile, and it makes me really happy.
For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan.
You can see photos of some of Andrea's favorite pieces from the joining project. We have them at PRI.org. All right, here's a question. How many of you leave butter on the counter so it'll be nice and soft when you want to spread it? Raise your hands.
It's disgusting to leave butter out on the counter because it's a dairy product and you need to make sure that it goes in the refrigerator.
Tori Starr works with us here at The World, and butter has become something of a battle in her relationship.
When my fiancé and I first moved in together, he would always leave the butter out on the kitchen counter. I would always put it back in the fridge because I just thought he was leaving it out and not realizing that he was doing it. And it turns out that when I went home to meet his entire family would leave the butter out.
So which is it? Butter in the fridge or out? Chef George Mendez is the owner of Aldea Restaurant in New York. What does he make of Tori's belief that butter has to go in the fridge?
Butter, most of the time, is the number one ingredient that does not need to be in the refrigerator.
you know, at room temperature, it's perfectly safe.
But how do you know? In some cases, the labels on the foods are clear, you know, refrigerate after opening. But other times, we're just guessing. I mean, it just makes sense to keep the eggs in the fridge, right?
So years ago, I remember seeing Julia Child on PBS saying that you should always refrigerate your eggs.
That's my colleague, Jonathan Dyer. He's lived in the U.S. for years, but was really thrown when he visited his mother back in London.
We go and get eggs together. She goes to this farm, and there's this hut at the back of this farm, and the eggs just sitting there like in crates, and you just help in the warm sunshine, you just help yourself, and Mum leaves them out on the kitchen counter. And then the next day I get up and Mum says, what do you want for breakfast? I says, I think I fancy an omelette. And she goes, well, there are the eggs. And I'm thinking, well, they were out in the sun yesterday and they've been left out here overnight and it's a warm summer's day. So I try and I make myself this omelette and I live. And I do it the following day and I'm still alive. And every morning when I'm making myself this omelette, I think, is this going to be it? Is this going to be my final day killed by my mother's eggs it left out in the warm sunshine?
Jonathan survived, and that's because in Europe, eggs are different. Not the eggs, actually, but the way they're handled. Again, Chef Mendez.
A lot of Americans don't know that chickens naturally, when they lay their eggs, they have a protective coating on the shell itself, and that protects the egg white and the egg yolk.
In America, we wash off that protective coating and spray the eggs with a chlorine mist. So USDA rules still require refrigeration. Chef Mendez, any other words of wisdom about which foods should be stored in or out of the fridge?
Ketchup has got a lot of ingredients, and mustard especially, that has sometimes it has vinegars, all kinds of very high acidity level in its recipe that makes bacterial growth impossible. You know, and the same thing with mayonnaise. Mayonnaise is also perceived as being an ingredient that needs to be refrigerated all the time, and that's just not the case.
Oh, and tomatoes, for goodness sake, keep them out of the fridge. What are your thoughts on the fridge, no fridge debate? Let us know on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/PRI the world. And you're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, John Cleese on when Monty Python members got back together for one last show.
Well, the funny thing is, whenever we get together, we laugh a lot. We always say we laugh more when we're together than any other time in our life. So we were laughing and laughing about a ridiculous legal case we got into, and somebody said, well, why don't we do a show? And that'll pay off the legal costs.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Israel is widening its ground offensive into Gaza today. That was apparent even before Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the official announcement. The Israeli Defense Forces have already mobilized artillery, tanks, ships, and planes. One main goal of the new offensive, to destroy a series of tunnels that extend from Gaza into Israeli territory. I spoke to IDF spokesman Peter Lerner today. He told me that Israeli troops have already found 20 of those tunnels.
The underground Gaza that we are seeing is a huge network of tunnels, all interconnected, all supporting the terrorist mechanism, all enabling terrorists from moving from A to B without being spotted.
Lerner also said that once the tunnels are identified, they're destroyed.
We explode them, we detonate a charge inside them in order to crash the tunnel on its path. Ultimately, what we want to do is sever the connection between them and Israel and distance the terrorist activities as far as possible from our community.
Yesterday, Israel said IDF forces confronted a group of Palestinian militants who were attempting to infiltrate Israel using one of the tunnels. But the Gaza offensive is also aimed at stopping militants from firing rockets into Israel. And Lerner said there's progress on that front, too.
Well, indeed, we have seen a decline in rocket launching today. It's still a bit early to see if it's just circumstantial or more substance.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is a spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces. By the way, he told me that those tunnels are used by militants to assemble and move rockets around. I also asked AFP reporter Sara Hussein about the tunnels. She's in Gaza. We'll hear her response in a minute, but I started my conversation with Sara by asking her to give me a sense of what Gaza feels like tonight.
At the moment, we're seeing strikes, both airplane strikes and tank shelling in different parts of the Gaza Strip. We've seen several people killed today in that ongoing fire in different areas. The announcement by Israel of a ground invasion in some places created sort of a ghost town scenario, particularly in Gaza City. Although in other parts of the Gaza Strip where we were today, we did see people out and about going to the Friday prayers and shopping in the markets. In general, the atmosphere is quite tense. People are nervous and they're expecting that the shelling and the bombardment will intensify as night falls.
Are you able to get around, or are you just sort of huddling in one place and trying to gather information from different sources?
No, we are able to move to some areas. Today we were in Khan Yunus, for example, in the south. We traveled along the main road after consulting with various people to see whether the road appeared to be safe. We traveled to a couple of places in Khan Yunus, the hospital, a UN school where people who were fleeing areas close to the border were taking shelter. But there are other areas that we consider to be a no-go zone at this point, places in the north and elsewhere.
How are residents of Gaza faring? What are they telling you?
People are very afraid. I think the important point to emphasize in Gaza is that it's very difficult for people to know where they should go and where they can be safe. There are no bomb shelters in Gaza. There are no reinforced buildings that can withstand bombardment by tank shells or by airstrikes. And so people are terrified, really, for themselves and particularly for their children, because they don't know how to protect themselves and their families.
Now, the Israeli strategy that we've been hearing is that they're going for these secret tunnels. Is the activity by the Israeli ground forces in particular areas, say, along the Israeli-Gaza border, or is it kind of within the strip as well at different points?
No, our understanding is that they're more concentrated along the border area. And the impression that we've been given also from what we've heard from our Jerusalem bureau is that that is going to be the modus operandi when it comes to this incursion, that they will be focusing on areas particularly along the border and places where there are tunnels and infrastructure that are used by militants in Gaza. We're not expecting to see Israeli soldiers rolling down the main streets of Gaza cities in tanks, at least at this stage of the operation.
What do people in Gaza tell you? I mean, you know, what we hear from Israelis is people in Gaza should be mad at Hamas. They've put them in this situation. Where is the anger in Gaza directed?
I think the anger in Gaza, in terms of the fear that people feel, is directed at the Israeli army, because those are the people who are identified by Gazans, by Palestinians in Gaza, as the ones who are firing at the Gaza Strip. And so while it may be the case, and while it is the case in some cases, that people here can see the link between the rocket fire that Hamas is doing and the concessions that Hamas is insisting upon for a truce to be negotiated and the fire that's coming from Israel, by and large, that anger is directed at Israel, because Israel is the one that's firing at the Gaza Strip and at homes and at buildings and creating situation for people where they feel, and they are, in fact, completely unsafe.
Now, Sarah, you've reported from Gaza for years. Is it different this time?
It's different and it's the same. There's a lot about this scenario that's very similar to the war that I covered here in 2012. The difference, I would say, this time, apart from the fact, obviously, that we're now seeing an actual ground invasion by Israel, which we didn't see in 2012, although it has happened in Gaza before, is that there doesn't seem to be the same talk about movement towards a truce that we had from almost day three, I would have said, from during the last war in 2012. The stop and start nature of discussions here about a truce is much more pessimistic than the discussions that we saw in the sort of mobilization that I remember in 2012 to get towards a ceasefire. And so the feeling here is that this is not something that's going to end very quickly.
Sarah Hussein is a reporter with AFP. She's in the Gaza Strip. Sarah, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
For another perspective on the conflict in Gaza, we reached out to Michael Oren. He's an historian, author, and former Israeli ambassador to the United States. I asked him how he's feeling about Israel's widening ground offensive.
Well, I feel, on one hand, great concern, because as with so many military conflicts, you know how they start and you don't know how they end. On the other hand, I feel a great sense of relief and of pride. We've been under fire here for about 2 weeks, being the targets of now about 1,300 rockets fired at civilian neighborhoods, including my own, from Gaza. And I'm very prideful that Israel has a citizens army And about 40,000 reservists so far have volunteered, showed up for service, and are going into battle to defend their country. It's always remarkable to see that here, Carl.
Now, Michael, help us better understand the Israeli strategy here. You're an historian. Israel's gone into Gaza three times in the past 6 years. Other two were in 2008, mm-hmm. 2012. What's different this time?
Well, what's different this time is certainly the diplomatic context. Egypt is under a government which is deeply hostile to Hamas. The Hamas is very isolated in the world. It's impoverished. So Israel today enjoys advantages that it did not enjoy in the past.
Those other two incursions into Gaza weren't terribly successful. They didn't gain a whole lot. And you're saying, though, this time the context is different, so the outcome's going to be different?
It could be. As I said earlier, in any military operation, you know how they start, but you don't know how they end. And one of the lessons of the past is that it only takes one errant tank shell that kills a great number of civilians, and the course of the battle, and certainly the diplomacy surrounding the battle, can change. It can give rise to tremendous shifts in public opinion, which can end up in the Security Council and condemnations and even sanctions.
Now you've just alluded to this yourself in terms of world reaction to this. You were Israel's representative in the U.S., and so you know how this kind of looks to the outside world. You know, Israel has all this firepower. It goes into Gaza. It's a strip of land about twice the size of Washington, D.C., you know, with 1.8 million people who are kind of penned in. They can't go anywhere. Do you feel like Israel needs to explain itself?
I definitely think Israel has to explain itself, and we can always do a better job of it, too. The bottom line is that someone who has been doing this for well over 30 years is that it's very difficult sometimes to translate our surreal situation here. You'd be sitting in your living room or going shopping or bringing your kids to a kindergarten, and all of a sudden there'll be a barrage of rockets coming down your head.
Of course, the surreal nature of it is also true for Palestinians in Gaza in terms of, you
it
know,
is, indeed.
So that situation exists
and
there
I think,
as well.
I think that we Israelis and Palestinians are both victims of Hamas.
My final question, Michael Oren, the land offensive comes after 10 days of intense airstrikes by Israel and obviously a lot of rockets from Gaza. At a certain point, is there a limit to the human toll of this conflict?
Is there a limit to the toll? Well, with 4 hours north of here, a short drive, you're in Boston. The difference between Boston and New York will be in downtown Damascus. There, nearly 200,000 people have been killed, Syrians killing Syrians. You drive just east of here about 6 hours, you're going to be in Iraq, in the middle of that fighting there. So we're surrounded by conflicts which have just monumental human costs. Sometimes they attract less attention in the media than our conflict does, probably for all sorts of reasons. I think, that, again, in comparison to previous rounds of casualties, rounds of fighting in Israel and Hamas, so far the casualties are lighter. Does that mean that, that civilians won't continue to suffer? They probably will, but again, it's because Israel is fighting an enemy that is using this population as a human shield. It's dug in deep beneath this population.
Michael Oren is former Israeli ambassador to the United States. We've been speaking to him from Israel. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
Children are among the dead in Gaza, but children in Israel are also ducking for cover because of the threat from militant rocket fire. Daniela Cheslow reports on a summer camp in Jerusalem where 100 Jewish and Arab children are trying to stay connected, keep safe, and have fun.
Project Harmony is run at Jerusalem's only Arabic-Hebrew bilingual school, the Max Rein Hand-in-Hand School. Kids have been coming together here for 5 years, but this is the first time the kids are coming during war. Efrat Meir, who manages camp, says the staff made sure everyone was prepared.
Camp started July 6th. It started already when we knew that the environment is not so stable. The first day we talked to the kids about that it might be a little bit stressful, but then the real violence started a bit later. The first thing we did after the first night with the sirens was to make sure they all know where the shelters are and to do another drill.
There's an all-American rah-rah spirit here, and that's both because camp is in English and because it was co-founded by Lexi Tabachnik from Philadelphia. There are 23 counselors, mostly American. Campers range in age from 9 to 14.
I'm Rafi Filimon, and I'm 12 years old.
Rafi's sitting with his friend Emmanuel Samara, who's 11. They're both Christian Palestinians. Rafi goes to the hand-in-hand school year-round. Emmanuel says Rafi's mom kind of sprang camp on them.
His mother gave us a paper to fill, like, she told us about the camp. So we filled it.
All the kids eat lunch together. Today it's a giant pot of maklube, a Palestinian dish made with rice and fried vegetables. There's no meat at camp, so no one has to worry about breaking Jewish or Muslim dietary laws. So far this summer, there's also no pool. Staff was worried about the rockets. Still, the kids do usual camp stuff. Sports, movies, arts and crafts. Today is sports day, and since they're doing these activities as Arabs and Jews, the kids learn about each other. Take language, for example. Here's Emmanuel.
I was happy when I heard them like speaking Arabic because they are Jews, like speaking Arabic. But in the R, they say because of this, sometimes you don't understand them.
It sounds maybe like
I'm Inbar Shaked Vardi.
Inbar is a Jewish Israeli. She's 14. She has curly hair, wears glasses. Her friend Lelia Ben-Horin is 14 too, and the bottom half of her brown hair is dyed hot pink. They both go to the school year-round. Inbar says her friends outside don't understand, especially now.
Right when it started, most of them were mad at me that I go here, that I speak to Arabs, because when three kids has been murdered and everybody thinks that who did it are Palestinians, Palestinians become enemies. You can't, like, it's really hard to stop it.
Emmanuel says he doesn't plan on telling anyone where he spent the summer. His normal school has no Jewish students, and he doesn't think his friends would get why he's here.
If they hear at my friends in school, they would say, you love Jews, you love Jews, you love Jews. In front of my friends, I say, I don't love Jews, because they make it a big deal.
Another thing these kids share? Just being kids in a time of war. While I visit, we hear gunshots and only find out later that Palestinian kids were shooting in the air to celebrate the results of their final exams. But the initial fear we all felt underscores the relief of this camp and the school itself. I ask if the Jews feel like they're cheering on their team, while Arab kids might be rooting for Hamas.
I don't think we have teams. I think this war isn't like between like Jews and Arabs, it's between like insane people who are full of hate, and like in this camp we're all together, all of us are good people who are not willing to hate and kill.
For the world, I'm Daniela Cheslow, Jerusalem.
Coming up, John Cleese of Monty Python fame, but he's here to talk about British tabloid culture. And you're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Earlier in the week, we talked about George Clooney's spat with the British tabloid The Daily Mail. At the time, we put in a call to actor and writer John Cleese, who's been outspoken about his disgust with Britain's tabloid culture and the toll it takes on people, famous and ordinary. He called us back and joins me now on the line from London, where he's finishing up the last few live performance reunion shows with Monty Python. John Cleese, it's always been a challenge for us to kind of explain the tabloid culture of Britain. We have tabloids here. They're different. They don't seem to have the reach or the impact. You just kind of see them in the supermarket checkout counter, you move on. Why do they have such huge impact in Britain?
It's a very good question. I suspect it's to do with the decline of educational standards, because if you look even at what used to be a very decent newspaper, The Telegraph, then they're trying to put a large picture of a good-looking woman on the front page every day. I mean, this is extraordinary for a so-called quality newspaper. I mean, the Sun started it. You see, Rupert Murdoch took the Sun newspaper down market in a way it had never been taken down market before, because he was the only newspaper proprietor there's ever been in England who did not want to be made a peer. He did not want to be Lord Murdoch, so he didn't care about keeping his nose clean with the establishment. So he took the sudden down market, and then the other papers had to follow because it was so successful. And what happened is that the tabloid journalism then spread to the sort of middle range papers. I mean, the Mail was not thought of as a tabloid 20 years ago, but it is now. And then that spread to papers like the Times and the Telegraph. And the whole thing is now into some form of very low grade entertainment. There's very little good writing. There are certainly some very, very fine columnists that I read now and again. But by and large, the whole standard has dropped. But you've got to start somewhere. And I think you need to start with a paper that is so dishonest that it runs stories that it knows not to be true, provided only that its lawyers have said they can't be sued for them.
Give us an example of how the Daily Mail has treated you.
I'll give you a very simple example. My wife, Jenny, there was a story early on when Jenny and I were together that suggested that she danced naked in order to keep my attention or to make sure the relationship continued. I mean, of course, we roar with laughter at it, but there are people out there who actually think there might be something in it. And the point is, Carol, which is quite funny, if it was true, and I can promise you it isn't, how would they know?
So it seems like you want the press itself, outside of the Daily Mail, to call Daily Mail on its reporting.
Well, it's hard to get a very corrupt press to call an even more corrupt newspaper. I think it's got to come from outside the press. And one of the problems in this country is that the press is, in quotes, regulated by a thing called the Press Complaints Commission, which, believe it or not, is financed by the newspapers. And the code of conduct is one that's set up by newspaper editors. Well, what a joke, you know, judge and jury and all that.
Now, you take this issue very seriously, and it's interesting because you're better known for your silliness. Where does this come from in you?
Oh, I'm not silly all the time. I'm mainly silly for money, you know. Otherwise, I'm just an ordinary, lower middle class, fairly well-educated guy who's fairly appalled by the standards of what used to be called Fleet Street. Does that answer your question?
So I had to look at the Daily Mail, the most recent headline about you. And of course, it's about the live performances that you're finishing up in London. And the headline said, "End of the road for those silly walks. John Cleese can't perform Monty Python stunt anymore because he has a dodgy knee." How did you respond to that headline?
Well, there's no point in responding to it, but, you know, and they also were extremely insulting, particularly insulting about Carol Cleveland, you know, who's in her 70s and is in extraordinary physical condition. She's wonderfully fit. She looks very, very good indeed. The Mail critic was absolutely scathing about her appearance. And I think, is this theatrical criticism? And the answer is, yes, it is in the Daily Mail.
How would you change the system if you could?
Well, you have to bring in a system of independent regulation. The Hacked Off campaign, which I'm associated with Hugh Grant and a lot of other people, that's what we're trying to get done. But the problem is that when the BBC wants someone on from Hacked Off and we want to send along a professor of communications or a lawyer or a judge who's on our side, they say, no, we want a personality. So you get the impression that the only people who are concerned are actors or, you know, celebrities. All over Britain, people are appalled by this paper. And yet, for some reason, they continue to read it. And I think it's because they simply do not realize that it lies.
Now, I can't leave you without asking you about the live performances. You guys, I read somewhere you have a combined age of 361 and you're out there doing a live show. What persuaded you to get together and do a live show at this point?
Well, the funny thing is, whenever we get together, we laugh a lot, Carol. We always say we laugh more when we're together than any other time in our life. So we were laughing and laughing about a ridiculous legal case we'd got into. And somebody said, well, why don't we do a show, which we'd last thought of doing in 1999. And that'll pay off the legal costs and with a bit to spare. And we all sort of laughed and said, well, that might be fun. And we thought about it and thought, why not? And we talked to a friend we know and he said, well, why don't you do it in an arena? And we said, well, that'd be interesting. God, we've never done that. And I personally love having new experiences. I wouldn't be enjoying this or having such a good time if we were in an ordinary West End theatre of 1,200, but we're in the O2 and performing to 16,000 every night. And it's not a theatrical performance. These are basically people people who've loved our stuff for 40 years and are kind of coming to say goodbye. And it's, in some ways, it's really quite touching because they are thanking us for making them laugh and we're kind of thanking them for thanking us. It's a very special occasion. It's the friendliest audience I've ever played to in my life. And I think they're getting some good stuff because when the audience is that friendly, the actors relax. And then little things happen that have never happened before and the audience love that.
So you kind of feel like Mick Jagger out there?
I know. I've never been to pop concerts or rock concerts. I'm the strangest man in the world in my musical taste, so I don't really know what they're like. But it's what I've noticed about rock, there's a lot of cheering. What I like is the laughter.
John Cleese is a writer, actor, and tall person. That's what it says on his website. He's also very passionate about the issue of British tabloids and the quality of journalism. John Cleese, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure because I don't see how a democracy can function if there isn't reasonably clear, honest, and accurate information out there.
We reached out to the Daily Mail for comment. The tabloid didn't get back to us in time for this broadcast, so the argument continues.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument's a collective series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue, I must take up a
World's theme was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bell Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. The Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today. More at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.